All this week, by the way, NPR is taking a deeper look at the natural gas boom in the United States. It's supplying America with cheap, abundant energy and pumping billions of dollars into the economy, but there are questions about what the gas boom is doing to our air and our water. Tomorrow on Morning Edition, we'll hear from sick patients living near gas wells and the doctors searching for answers. Here's a preview of what's to come in our series, The Fracking Boom, Missing Answers.
It's just a who's who toxic chemical mix. Pretty much all of those items that you get from petroleum products are spewing into the air in this area.
I worry about my health. I worry about my kids' health.
It's the unknown, I think, that is the scariest thing.
Run. Run as fast as you can. Grab up your family and your belongings and get out.
You can't make assumptions about health impacts if you don't have the data to support it.
If it turned out that it wasn't the oil and gas industry, that was fine with me.
We're talking about an enormous number of people who are potentially at risk to have their conditions worsened by these exposures.
We're not out to get anybody. We just want to let the facts lead us wherever they will.
And our series, The Fracking Boom, begins later today on All Things Considered. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
From NPR News, it's Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz. And this is the sound last night from the streets and public squares across Spain. We are indignant, they sing, the indignados, now a mass movement in Spain, railing against austerity measures imposed by the European Union. In Greece today, Alexis Tsipras, the head of a far-left opposition party, held a news conference where he said he wouldn't join a coalition government that continued along the path of austerity.
Όχι μόνο δεν έχουν λάβει το μήνυμα της λαϊκής ετοιμιγορίας.
Tsipras called the European bailout plan for Greece blackmail. Of the 17 countries that are part of the euro, 8 are now in recession. More are expected to go into recession this year. So how did it happen? That's our cover story today, Europe's economic implosion and how it could eventually affect us here at home. Former top economic advisor to President Obama, Christina Romer, will answer that question in a moment. Let's start with Greece. Last weekend, voters threw their support behind far-left and far-right parties that oppose the terms of the European bailout. Greece has borrowed 240 billion euros to keep its economy afloat. But as a result, the government's had to slash pensions, government salaries, and public services, along with raising taxes. And now, more than half of all young Greeks are out of work. And this week, as reporter Joanna Kakissis explains from Athens, the dueling political parties were supposed to figure out a way to form a new governing coalition.
And that hasn't happened because there's been a split between parties who oppose the terms of the bailout and parties who support the terms of the bailout. And the parties that support the terms of the bailout are the mainstream parties who just were pummeled at the polls. People really punished them. The party that came in second is a party called Syriza. They're a leftist party. They were in 2009, a very small party with, you know, just a tiny percentage of the votes in parliament. But now they've surged because people have really connected to that message that the euro is associated with pain and the bailout is associated with pain. And they want some politician to go to Brussels and stand up to the Europeans and say, no more austerity. There's got to be another way for us to recover from this recession.
That's Joanna Kakissis from Athens. Greece is now in its fifth year of recession with no relief in sight. And while America's economy is set to grow by as much as 3% this year, Europe's will contract. A growing chorus of economists and politicians in Europe are blaming one thing, a strict austerity regime engineered by Germany. And to find out why the Germans have been so rigid in their demands for fiscal discipline, we called Martin Wolf, chief economics commentator for the Financial Times.
The Germans rejected Keynesianism, fundamentally root and branch. To them, economics is a branch of moral philosophy, and it's immoral to promote growth by increasing fiscal deficits. That's the lesson they took out of the 20s and 30s. I think it's completely misguided. But anyway, it's deeply entrenched. Second, the Germans feel our fiscal position's okay and our economy's doing okay. It's not doing great, actually, but it's doing okay. Why should we use our credit to support the borrowing by weaker countries in Europe who have mismanaged their affairs. So imagine that the U.S. didn't have a federal government, and you had a state, I don't know, Texas, let us say, which had a really strong fiscal position and all the others were rather weak. How willing would the Texans be to guarantee the borrowing of all the other states? The answer is they wouldn't. So that's essentially the political setup in Europe is not one in which there is this will to collective action because there isn't a collective actor.
So it increasingly seems that the White House, along with the International Monetary Fund, have been opponents of this European austerity plan. And some even suggest that the White House was happy to see Sarkozy lose the election in France. Of course, we don't know that for sure. But their argument is you cannot cut your way to growth. Is that a message that is backed up by evidence, by recent evidence?
My response to all this is that this is all nonsense economics in the sense that we seem to have got ourselves in a way of thinking about economics that there are permanent, eternal truths which apply in all circumstances, irrespective of precisely what's happened and why you are where you are. There are circumstances, depending on the nature of the crisis that has occurred, in which cutting the fiscal deficit sharply is fully compatible with a recovery. But in the current circumstances in Europe, I do not expect these programs to generate significant recovery with the possible exception, very small open economy with very competitive external sector of Ireland.
Let's talk about Greece for a moment. Greece has been in recession for 5 years. It has a 20% unemployment rate and it's rising with no end in sight. Portugal is in a somewhat similar situation and Spain may be headed towards that place. What advantages does Greece have in staying in the Eurozone right now? Why not just get out of it and default and deal with the consequences?
It has to be stressed that for Greece, leaving the euro, introducing a new currency, has its own gigantic risks. The process itself will be immeasurably chaotic. The legal situation Greece will be in is unclear. In EU law, leaving is illegal, and technically, it would leave the European Union itself, which could mean that it would lose all the trade benefits of being part of the single market. There will be some very complicated negotiations around that set of questions. Then there's obviously the question of introducing the new currency, creating a new banking system in a context in which the government would more or less have imploded. And there will be civil strife, I think. It's not clear whether they could stabilize this currency. They might end up in hyperinflation.
Is the euro going to survive?
I have wobbled on this, and I try to be as dispassionate as I possibly can. But at the moment, looking at the next 10 years and the adjustments that are required, because they certainly haven't fixed it yet, I would tend to put it subjectively somewhere between 1 in 3 and 1 in 2 chances of collapse. And at the moment, I'm closer to 1 in 2 chance of collapse.
That's Martin Wolf, the chief economics commentator for the Financial Times. Mark Bly, the professor of international political economy at Brown, has been writing about why he believes austerity will ultimately fail in Europe.
It hasn't worked at all, and it was quite predictable that it wouldn't work. Here's the problem. It's kind of two truths simultaneously. So the first truth is you can't cure debt with more debt. Now, this begs the question as to why they keep giving the Greece more money. But nonetheless, you can't cure debt with more debt. But here's something else that's true. If everyone tries to pay back the debt all at the one time, all you end up doing is shrinking the economy. When you shrink the economy, you end up reducing the amount of taxation that you can collect, thus the amount of debt you can pay back. So your debt-to-GDP ratio gets worse rather than better over time. In all of the countries that have begun austerity programs over the past 2 years, they now have more debt rather than less. That's the problem.
What happens if Europe sticks with its austerity regime? Will these economies eventually recover?
No, they will not. That's the tragedy of the whole thing, which is why even the Germans now are talking about tolerating a higher rate of inflation domestically and putting money into the various European development banks to offset the contraction. Ultimately, the Eurozone is a doomsday device. No one really wants to admit this, but it's turned out it is that way. You have all of these very levered banks. European banks are on average about 3 times the size of American banks. They're chock full of really bad assets. So you're having incredible vulnerabilities in the Eurozone. You can't devalue. You have no independent exchange rate. You can't run the printing press to monetize the debt. What they've built is the gold standard. And that, the last time we tried to run a gold standard in a democracy in Europe in the 1920s and 1930s, we know how that ended, and it didn't end very well.
Mark Blythe from Brown University. So what about the ripple effects on our economy? Christina Romer, who was once President Obama's top economic advisor, says they could be significant.
Europe is one of our biggest trading partners. So when they fall back into recession, they're buying less from us. And that means less demand for American businesses. Our financial markets are intimately connected with European financial markets. So if they have a breakup of the euro that starts a financial panic, there's no way that New York is not affected by that.
Many economists, including members of the Fed Board, are predicting that economic growth in this country will be somewhere between 2.75% to 3%, maybe a little higher this year. What practical impact would a return to recession in Europe and in many more countries in Europe, because of course some countries are already in recession, what impact would that have on our own recovery and that growth trajectory?
What I think really worries American policymakers is what happens if things get much worse? What happens if this political instability in Greece suddenly has Greece leaving the euro and, you know, suddenly we're seeing financial panic again? That's when the effects could be very large, because if you have a true financial crisis in Europe, if you have countries starting to leave the euro, if you have much more severe recession, then it's a whole new ballgame.
Can we still have a relatively strong recovery in this country? And we're not there yet, obviously, but could we, even if most European countries continue to slide downward in their economic growth?
It's certainly going to be hard. You know, when we look at our own country and how are we going to get a robust recovery, a piece of that that the president has really emphasized is the importance of exports, that that's a source of demand that we really need to put our people back to work. And if Europe stays with very high unemployment, very low economic growth, they're one of our major trading partners, it's going to be really hard to get that piece of demand up for the United States. So I think until everybody starts growing again, it's going to be hard to see the really strong kind of growth, not the 2% growth, but the 4% growth that would really cause the American unemployment rate to come down quickly. That's going to be hard to do with Europe as distressed as it is.
That's Christina Romer. She's the former chair of the President's Council of Economic Advisers. In a moment, the latest from Germany on how voters there have sent a punishing message to Chancellor Angela Merkel's ruling coalition. Stay with us. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Back in 2002, Rafe Sagarin was working as a science advisor to Congresswoman Hilda Solis. She's now the Secretary of Labor. It wasn't long after 9/11, and Sagarin started noticing how some of his colleagues were dealing with the heightened security measures on Capitol Hill.
I'd watch these other Capitol Hill staffers, and I noticed that they just put their hand over their keys in their pockets so they didn't have to waste 30 seconds putting it on the conveyor belt, and that didn't set off the alarm when they did that. And it just made me think, adaptable organisms, if you're talking about an adaptable terrorist, is going to figure out a way to get around this. And I started to think about organisms in nature, which are constantly adapting, and started to think, well, what could we learn from all that adaptation in nature about how to make better security systems?
The animal he turned to? The octopus. Rafe Sagarin's new book is called Learning from the Octopus, and it describes how secrets from nature can help us avoid disasters. And when we spoke, I asked him, why the octopus?
Most adaptable systems, and the octopus is a great example, have a decentralized organization where a lot of almost independent parts are allowed to sense and respond to the environment. So the octopus doesn't use that great brain to tell arm one to turn purple and arm two to turn blue as it swims over a coral reef, but rather millions of cells spread across its body are each individually responding to that change in their environment and then giving camouflage to the octopus as a whole. That combination gives you a lot of what you need to be an adaptable organism.
These things are intuitive. There's just that amazing video that came out a year or so ago of an octopus using coconut shells to protect it as sort of this armor. The octopus just does those things, but you're suggesting that we focus our thought process on a range of possible options and reactions?
It's not completely intuitive. It does have a cognitive mind that thinks about these things. The coconut shells is a good example where it had to piece that together, but it also has these more automatic things. And we as humans have that as well, but we're sort of too clever by half by trying to plan and predict and make perfect solutions to our security problems, when in fact all of nature, including the octopus, don't spend a lot of time planning. They just try to solve problems in the environment as they arise.
There's an example you talk about with the U.S. military, the issue of IEDs, improvised explosive devices, which, as you point out, they're still among the biggest killers of our troops in Afghanistan and a scourge for many years in Iraq. What's your argument for why the military has not adapted to that threat?
Yeah, well, there you see two sides of adaptability. You had the Department of Defense, which planned for and predicted a certain kind of war, which turned out to be not the war at all that they were fighting. And it was all those soldiers on the ground who are acting as these semi-independent sensors, just like the skin cells on the octopus, who almost immediately recognized that the IED threat was the big problem. It took the Department of Defense, with a centralized, top-down control system, 3 years to bring out up-armored vehicles into Iraq. Those soldiers on the ground had to adapt in the meantime. And one of the things that they did is develop symbiotic partnerships, even with people that were previously shooting at them. And it was through those partnerships that they started to get the intel about the IEDs and who were the bomb makers and that sort of thing. And you see a big drop in IED deaths before these up-armored vehicles came into Iraq.
We often hear, and it seems pretty self-evident, that humans are actually very adaptable, that it might take us some time, but we do eventually figure it out. And I'm wondering, what example can we sort of take from the natural world and then apply it to our experience and say, we're just not doing that?
Well, it's really about this decentralized organization. That starts it all, and there's a very simple thing we can do in wherever we work that can shift us into this mode of having more sense of how the world is changing and having more ability to respond to it. And that is shifting from a mode of giving orders to issuing challenges, which is when we say, here's a problem we're all facing. Who among you can solve this problem best? And every time we've seen a challenge-based attempt at problem solving, you get many more potential responses and potential solutions. You get them much quicker and much, much more cheaply than the model where a small group of experts decides or a single contractor is decided to develop something.
That's Rafe Sagarin. He's a marine ecologist and author of the new book, Learning from the Octopus. Rafe Sagarin joined us from KUAZ in Tucson, Arizona. Rafe, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it.
On a Monday morning, a school day for many, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Philadelphia's school district is facing a financial crisis. After years of declining enrollment, the district projects a deficit next year of $218 million. So administrators are proposing to close down a quarter of the city's public schools. Parents are not happy, as NPR's Jeff Brady reports.
The School District of Philadelphia hasn't identified which neighborhoods could lose schools, but just the mention of getting rid of a quarter of the district's 250 buildings has led to some heated public hearings. Helen Gim is a parent and well-known activist in the city.
I would have hoped that you would have come in and you would have ripped out the things that we have been trying to rip out, the political graft, the corruption, the contracts, and every single person who felt like they could stick their program on our school's children's backs.
Gim believes there's money to be saved by canceling some of the district's professional services contracts and reviewing executive compensation. At that same hearing, Acting Superintendent Tom Knutson offered a sober assessment of the district's finances.
Years of slow economic growth have cut our resources significantly, even as our expenses have continued to rise. We are, quite simply, in a financial crisis.
The district's latest reform effort is called the Blueprint for Transforming Philadelphia's Public Schools. Looking out 5 years, Knutson says the budget hole expands to $1.1 billion.
If we do not take dramatic steps now to right ourselves, we will not be able to operate.
The blueprint proposes shutting down problem schools and focusing on those doing well. That could mean expanding charter schools. The blueprint also calls for decentralizing the district. Parent Rebecca Poyero suspects the goal is to privatize more of the public school system.
It is at best foolish and at worst devious for you to choose this moment of fiscal crisis to foist a poorly conceived and primarily ideological reorganization scheme on Philadelphia's schools.
Poyero says the overhaul and the current money problem should be viewed separately. Most parents speaking out against the blueprint say they want the district to clean up its finances, then lobby the city and the state for more money. Paul Hill has heard this before. He founded the Center for Reinventing Public Education based in Seattle. He says big city districts like Philadelphia were built to serve much larger enrollments.
If you don't have a growing population, you end up with a deficit. And so if you end up with a shrinking population, you have a big deficit, a crushing one, a bankrupting level one. And that's what's happened to a lot of these cities.
Philadelphia has lost 50,000 students in the past decade, mostly to charter schools and the suburbs. Officials like Wendell Pritchett with the School Reform Commission say something has to be done.
The point of these meetings is to come up with a better plan. It's a draft. It's easy to say your plan sucks. It's not easy to come up with an alternative.
District administrators hope to have a detailed plan by late summer. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Philadelphia.
The National Hockey League's Stanley Cup playoffs have reached the conference finals. In the East, the traditional rivals, the New York Rangers and the New Jersey Devils, play their first game tonight. And in the West, we have a somewhat less traditional rivalry as the LA Kings play the Phoenix Coyotes. Game one of their series came last night, and the Kings got the final goal from Dwight King.
Open net for King. He scores! Dwight King's second goal of the game is likely going to seal this one with just under 48 seconds remaining.
Indeed it did. That was the call from the NBC Sports Network as the Kings took the first game 4-2. It is a best-of-seven series, though. Lots of hockey to go. Here to discuss all of this is NPR's Mike Pesca. Mike, good morning.
Hello.
Okay, so the LA Kings get the first win of the series. These guys have attracted a lot of excitement because they barely made the playoffs at all.
Yeah, they were the eighth seed in the West, and they just win on the road. They set a record for having won their first six road games of 2012, which is good since they'll never have home ice advantage as the eighth seed in the West.
They're at the bottom,
Yeah, and if no one expected the Kings to make the playoffs, although hockey does have this tradition since 2006, three eighth seeds have been playing in the conference finals. But if no one expected the Kings to do well, Phoenix is, I guess, a coyote of an entirely different color because they're really, without exaggeration, the most beleaguered franchise in professional sports. Forbes rates them as the least valuable franchise. They've been bankrupt for the last 3 years. The NHL owns the team, desperately trying to find an owner. They haven't been able to find one. You know, what is this team doing having any success? But there they are on the verge of the Stanley Cup Finals.
I'm still recovering from you saying a coyote of a different color.
Yeah, they're purple.
But let me try to get out this next question. If you have a bankrupt team, are you more likely to get a buyer if you're in at least the conference finals of the Stanley Cup playoffs?
Well, yes, and it might be a little bit of coincidence. They do have a buyer, Greg Jamieson, who used to run the San Jose Sharks. He's interested. They've had a lot of people interested, but it's hard to work out a deal because the city of Glendale, though the 88th biggest city in the United States, decided to spend some of its taxpayer money every year on keeping a hockey team. So the only inducement for an owner is the fact that Glendale pays you. During the regular season, the Coyotes were last in the league in attendance, but they've been selling out playoff games, so maybe it can be attractive to have hockey in the desert as an ongoing enterprise.
Well, let's talk about hockey in the Northeast now, the Rangers and the Devils.
Yeah, they're playing right across the Hudson. You know, so everyone remembers, or most hockey fans remember, that in 1994, Marc Messier helped the Rangers end their 54-year drought. He raised that Stanley Cup in Madison Square Garden. But three times since then, the Devils have won the Stanley Cup there. If anything represents a tradition in the East, they're maybe the best team over the last 20 years. This is a rivalry I would recommend, if you're the kind of person who likes fisticuffs, to tune in early. Twice the teams have dropped the gloves exactly as the referees drop the puck. So it's going to be a rough series, but it should be a pretty good series. And the Rangers are the only number one team left. The Devils are a six seed. So what the NHL is staging is a playoffs where of the top 10 teams, only one remains. Maybe it will be the Rangers year again. They also have this streak of winning all these Game 7s at home, which they've never lost a Game 7 at home. It's kind of nice psychologically to have that in your back pocket.
So in a couple of seconds, I mean, sports writers play up these rivalries, but it sounds like this is a serious one. They really feel it.
They don't like each other. The Kings and Coyotes don't like each other. To be a hockey player is to not like the other hockey players.
Mike, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And we certainly like NPR's Mike Pesca. We keep bringing him back anyway, right here on Morning Edition from NPR News.